You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of July, 2014, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, we'll look at media coverage of the MH17 crash and ask whether access to the site has led to reckless reporting. Joining me in the studio are Jeffrey Kaufman and John Everard, who will also debate the diplomatic fallout and the political prospects for President Putin. We'll hear also how South American soap operas aren't just playing lip service to equal rights.
Usually the soap operas, they show some advances in Brazilian society. I remember in the 70s there was a big discussion about divorce. But I do have to say they were a bit late on this gay issue. For example, we had the first gay kiss earlier this year in January in the soap opera Amor à Vida, which was historic. I mean, everybody loved it. And not many people were shocked, to be honest.
And then later, our Bogota correspondent explains why Colombians are hoping FARC rebels will acknowledge their crimes.
The victims are looking, in fact, to go to Havana and face and speak to the FARC commanders, and they want to find out where the mass graves are, where people are being buried, and they want really an apology and some sort of formal act of forgiveness on behalf of the FARC.
That's Midori House right now with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up here in the next hour on Midori House, but before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron has today questioned France's plan to sell Mistral helicopter carriers to Russia, saying fulfilment of such an order would be unthinkable in Britain after the downing of the Malaysian Airlines plane in Ukraine. Cameron spoke as fighting flared in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk as investigators began to inspect the bodies of victims of the Malaysia Airlines flight MH17, which crashed last week. The British leader said the European Union should consider hard-hitting economic sanctions against Russia, including freezing the assets of President Vladimir Putin's closest allies, who Cameron called cronies and oligarchs. Meanwhile, Dutch experts and OSCE monitors have now checked the site to contradict early allegations that local workers treated the scene and the bodies disrespectfully. Ukraine's Prime Minister said he's willing to hand over control of the entire investigation into the crash to a foreign agency, possibly led by the Netherlands. Arseniy Yatsenyuk said he's certain what he called professionals brought the aircraft down using a Russian missile system, and he promised to bring them to justice.
We will bring to justice everyone responsible, including the country which is behind the scene, but supplied a lethal weapon, provided the financial support, trained these bastards, and supported, and even orchestrated, this kind of despicable crime.
10 people have been killed, including a mother and 3 children, in a government airstrike on a militant-controlled town north of Baghdad on Monday, hospital sources and witnesses have said. The attack targeted the town of Hawija, 140 miles from the capital, which is controlled by Sunni Muslim insurgents from the Islamic State and other groups opposed to Iraq's Shiite-led government. An Israeli tank shell has hit the third floor of Al-Aqsa Hospital in central Gaza, killing 4 people and wounding 16. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, 501 people have now died there during Israel's operation against Hamas militants, with over 3,000 injured. Efforts to broker a ceasefire continue, with Egypt saying it might amend its latest truce initiative in order to accommodate the Palestinian militant movement Hamas, which has rejected its previous terms. Well, Monocle 24's Eastern Mediterranean correspondent Joseph Dana says the role of the United States rather than Egypt was more crucial in bringing about that ceasefire.
We see this new constellation of the kind of Israeli-Egyptian-American brokering on the ceasefire that Hamas has been rejecting over the past week. There's a very interesting diplomatic sway that's going on in the region that Kerry's going to want to, you know, attempt to control to ensure that the United States still has that central position. But in terms of stopping the violence and the bloodshed, the Americans really do hold the power in this situation.
U.S. President Barack Obama has signed an order on Monday protecting federally contracted workers from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. A religious organization would be barred from making hiring decisions based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Exceptions would be allowed for ministers. Obama's order updates a a previous order by President Lyndon Johnson by adding sexual orientation and gender identity to a list of protected categories for federal contractors. And finally, staying in the United States, two men hired to clean out a rental house in Florida thought they found a Halloween-typed mannequin hanging in the garage, so they cut it down and took it to a landfill. But workers at the dump near Tampa grew suspicious of its foul odor and called authorities, who realized that the workers had actually brought in a dead man in a mummified state. And that gruesome story ends this bulletin of Monocle 24 News.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're right back after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, това е Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18:06. Which means it's 13:06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio are Jeffrey Kaufman and John Everard. Welcome both to the programme. Well, there's only one place we can start today, and that's with the Malaysian airline crash, which is not only a tragedy for the families and friends of the many victims, but is now turning into a diplomatic disaster as more countries begin to point the finger at Russia's president for providing the weapon that apparently shot the plane down. There's been a chorus of criticism over the handling of corpses at the site, which were left for hours in the sun, and also anger at the lack of access for independent investigators. Gentlemen, it's a complicated story and a story which is being played out now with a kind of a terrible kind of politics on both sides. But what seems to be evident is, you know, that the Europeans, the Americans firmly believe that it was the rebels that shot the plane down and that action should be taken against Vladimir Putin. John, let's just start with you on this. Do you think there, while there's the pressure coming from Washington, in Europe it's still very unclear that anybody is willing to kind of face up to Putin? You know, Cameron speaks quite loudly about it. But the closer you get to being connected to Russia's oil pipelines, gas pipelines, then the kind of willingness to kind of, you know, step out of line and do anything seems to diminish.
Well, it's not just a relationship with your proximity to Russia's gas pipelines. It's also how close you are to clinching a deal to sell helicopter carriers to Russia, which, of course, weighs heavily in Paris. Yes, Europe is interconnected with the Russian economy in the way that the United States simply is not. And the Europeans stand to lose a great deal more if tougher sanctions are applied. Nevertheless, I think, as you say, the pressure is on now. And the conversations that have been taking place between the European leaders over the last couple of days seem to me to suggest that at tomorrow's meeting of European foreign ministers, that new sanctions will be announced. I mean, I don't think we know yet just how extensive they'll be or how far they'll go to meeting American concerns, but Europe is certainly moving.
Jeffrey, there's been some suggestion that one of the easiest ways to kind of move this story along is to kind of hit the oligarchs, and that, you know, they are the supporters of Putin. They kind of give the cash and they make the whole system work. Do you think that's a likely target for sanctions?
Well, I think, as you've already noted, that Europe has to walk. Reality forces Europe to walk a very careful line here. Europe is dependent on Russian gas and oil, and Germany in particular, but the Baltic states, Italy, all desperately need that gas and oil come this winter. So they can't afford to antagonize Putin. But at the same time, I agree with your statement when you began. This has now reached a level where it is so morally repugnant. And Putin's cynical, self-serving, two-faced approach to this is so glaring to those of us in the West that not to act now becomes in itself an acquiescence that I think that people are finding harder and harder to tolerate.
But do you think he cares though? That's the thing I don't get is, you know, he must know what actually happened and he's had every report and he knows, you know, what's going on the border. Do you think he cares about his standing in the West, or, you know, is this simply about Russian nationalism, and as long as it serves that cause in the end and he's, you know, seen as standing up to, you know, what they regard as Ukrainian fascists, as long as he's doing that, can he get away with anything at home?
I think it's difficult to draw a clear line between Russian nationalism and Putin's concern for the way Russia looks in the West. This Russian prestige is close to the heart of what is going on. The reason that Putin did what he did over Crimea was because he could not afford to be the Russian president who, quote, lost, unquote, Ukraine, so he wanted to turn himself into the president who got Crimea back. And the reasons driving Russian policy in eastern Ukraine are similar. So, yes, he cares very much. He doesn't, I think, give a hoot about the humanitarian aspects of this. I don't think he's at all concerned that so many people have died. But he does care very deeply about the damage that this terrible incident, has caused to his standing, both internationally and domestically. And if I could just pick up a point with Jeffrey was coming towards there, the repugnance that people feel towards what has happened, I don't think is limited to the West. I think one of the major disaster areas for Putin is that his reputation outside the West has plummeted. I mean, Malaysia obviously is incandescent. It could have been a lot worse. There were three airliners in the sky at the moment that missile was fired. It hit, as we know, the Malaysian airliner. It was just 2 or 3 minutes away from hitting an Indian airliner. The rebels came very close to blasting Russia's major arms export market out of the sky.
You know, I don't think that Putin, you know, as cynical as he may be and as skeptical as we are about him, I don't think Putin would have ever wanted this to happen. And I'm sure that privately he is cursing those who sent his missiles into the air to knock this down. And I think on one level he is insulated because he essentially is an elected dictator and therefore he can do as he pleases. He is the czar of the 21st century. That being said, we've all seen in our lifetimes how politics sometimes can begin at one place and end in an unexpected place. And this is so big now for him that well, on one level, we can say he doesn't care. I think, as John's mentioned, you know, this is hurting him in Africa. It's hurting him in Asia. And Russia's stature as a leading power really is potentially compromised by this.
John, I wanted to ask you a little question about, you know, he's meant to be going to the G20 in Australia. We've seen at the weekend, you know, the comments coming out of Australia, you know, a suggestion there, you know, by Abbott that, you know, we were watching, you know, criminals running a crime scene effectively with what's happening in Eastern. Can he, you know, that's what I wonder diplomatically. Can he begin to turn up at things and, you know, shake hands with Merkel, sit alongside Cameron, you know, take the photo calls, go to Australia? It seems his credibility is so terrible now, and that he is seen for what he is, for the, you know, that I just don't see how he can go.
It's going to be very difficult for him. I think, you know, Putin's instinct will be just to tough it out. We saw the extreme of this in France just a few weeks ago, where President Hollande, of course, had to have two dinners one night because Obama would not sit and have dinner with Putin. So Hollande has to host the two of them. I suspect that if he does force his way into the G20, and I think Australia's made very clear its reluctance to see him attend, then we're going to have more of the same. People simply will not want to be seen or not want to be photographed standing next to Putin.
Jeffrey, could this be the beginning of the end of him?
Well, you know, I think some people might wish that. I think it's premature, but I would say this. Remember, it was only months ago that we saw a $50 billion spectacle in Sochi, all designed to rebrand Russia as the modern country that can. All of that money is now lost. I mean, we knew it then when we saw those the empty seats in the hockey arenas. But now they've got the World Cup in 4 years. This is, you know, this is a man who clearly cares about Russia's stature in the world. You don't go for an Olympics and a World Cup back to back unless you're trying to make a point. And, you know, and look who's going after these kind of events now. These are countries that want to brand themselves in a certain way in the eyes of the world. Putin can't have it both ways. And I think tragically, the extraordinary the tragedy of MH17. But even more so, the way he has handled this or pretended it's not his problem has made it impossible for him to move his country forward.
That's the international aspect. And I agree entirely with what Jeffrey said. There's also a very complex domestic aspect of this.
Yes, so I wanted to ask what the public was thinking of him back in Russia, do you think?
Okay, well, the public, the survey suggests that they're horrified. They're very worried, apparently, that America is going to start a war with Russia over this. And the usual panic-stricken rumors are going right around Moscow. This happens alarmingly often. But basically, to stay in power, Putin has to keep two groups of people happy. The essentially plutocratic, the oligarchs, who are very much in favor of close links with the West so they can trade and make even more money. And at the same time, the nationalists, chest-thumping Russian, quote, patriots, unquote, who regard the collapse of the Soviet Union as an unmitigated disaster. Right now, he is seriously annoying both groups.
Yeah.
The oligarchs are annoyed with him because the sanctions are hitting them. They, if you are on the blacklists, you cannot effectively transact in dollars, which is a very, very big problem if you're talking about the amounts of money that these people are trying to handle. The nationalists are furious because he hasn't gone in big into Ukraine, which, of course, he can't.
Jonathan, I just want to pick up with both of you about the kind of the media coverage here. What's happening in Russia as well is very complicated. But some of the media coverage that we've seen over the weekend has not been great on the Western side.
We're talking about Sky TV.
Yeah, we're talking
London.
About Sky TV, and we're talking about a reporter, Colin Brazier. I was actually happened to be watching live as he. This is a British reporter who was at the crash site and found himself standing next to a pile of people's suitcases and started going through one of the suitcases live on air. And actually, I think caught himself in that terrible moment and said, "We shouldn't be doing this." What's either of your reading of that?
Well, as a reporter, the first reading is that. Listen, as a journalist who has always fought for free access, I completely understand why crime scenes should not be open to reporters. So not to defend that reporter, but in any normal circumstance, there would be police tape and there would be guards saying, "You don't go across this line. This is a crime scene. Don't touch." So let's establish that these thugs who are controlling it, these so-called pro-Russian separatists, have completely hijacked what should be a very orderly procedure.
Even though that should have been in place, it wasn't a good moment.
No,
for
no,
Sky.
I wouldn't defend him. I think he completely his judgment, as I'm sure he now knows, was completely off, and he was wrong. I would say something about the media coverage that goes back to what John was just saying, and that is that surprisingly, I think for a lot of Westerners, a lot of people in eastern Ukraine actually believe that the Ukrainian government shot this plane down. There is a lot of Kremlin orchestrated propaganda going on the airwaves saying this, and in fact it was a statement again today, and the Kremlin has issued a number of images today showing evidence in quotes that this was in fact a Ukrainian surface to air missile, and people believe that, the majority of people in that area.
So do we need a moment of pause here actually for both sides to kind of let's get some evidence, because if everyone's piling in this, everyone's claiming each other's, putting up forged information, the Russian coverage looks incredibly suspect. And if you're looking on any of the blogs today, that there are so many kind of Kremlin employees kind of jumping in to kind of go onto blogs and being kind of the finger pointed at them. But is there maybe actually a pause that needed on both sides here? But before we definitely have trial and jury from all of these world leaders, we just kind of get some evidence.
Well,
I think
we're starting to see evidence of it. I think today we're hearing that the so-called Russian separatist rebel leaders are going to hand over both the bodies and the black boxes to Malaysian authorities. And if that's the case, then that's a recognition. And one assumes they've had a little pressure from Russia and maybe from Moscow directly, that it is really unacceptable that these bodies have been held hostage. And if that breaks, and if the black boxes go to Malaysia, then we're seeing some of what you're talking about. If those black boxes end up in Moscow for deciphering, then the problem only gets worse.
John, I want to ask you one quick, going back to the sky question almost. One of the terrible things watching the news over the weekend is I wonder whether rolling news is to blame, because actually lots of the coverage, you have a guy stuck in a field for a whole day trying to talk, and you cannot deliver the same consistency all the time. I was watching the BBC, and actually I found the BBC coverage not great. They were standing outside Schiphol Airport, and they were asking people, because they had nothing to ask, in the queue, relatives of people, what are you going to be writing in the book? It's none of your business. This is a private moment when people are going to express their grief. And they were trying to, you know, Dutch people seem very reserved about this. Do you think sometimes this rolling news is the sin here?
I think, yes, rolling news put journalists under intense pressure. And we've seen, I think, a couple of occasions in this tragedy where journalists have done things that I'm sure they will come to regret. But can I come back to the very strong point you made earlier that, about the need for evidence and a pause? I agree entirely. I think we do need evidence. I'm deeply worried that the black boxes are now in the hands of the separatists. And even if they are handed over to the civil aviation authorities, I think there's a very real risk that we'll find that they've been tampered with. And I suspect that they will be tampered with in a way that suggests that the missile may not have been a surface-to-air missile, but an air-to-air missile, which is the current Russian myth.
I must say, I think it would be hard to do that this quickly. I mean, the technology to do that doesn't exist in Donetsk and eastern Ukraine. They would have to go to Moscow. They'd have to be opened. And I think the tampering would show. I think, to me, the bigger concern is the crime scene being pillaged by local people, not just the obscenity of removing gold rings and watches from corpses, but also the idea that some of the evidence of this missile has been removed. Remember, when Lockerbie went down, it was only a tiny fragment of a detonator that proved what the bomb actually was. And every little bit matters.
We're going to have to pause for a second because we have another important topic to get to. A short break, and then we're going to come back to discuss Gaza.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monaco, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Now we turn our attention to the ongoing violence in the Gaza Strip, where Palestinian officials have today said that the death toll has reached 500. Well, the UN Security Council has called for an immediate ceasefire. So far, there's no sign of that being heeded. The US Secretary of State, John Kerry, is expected to arrive in Israel later today, where he will begin again to try and bring both sides back from the brink. John, again, isn't it, you know, a terrible, terrible story. 500 people killed. And there seems to be no script that really kind of gets us out of the situation. Because, you know, for Hamas, you know, where do they stop now? You know, they've got 500 people killed. How do they show they've got any gains? For the Israelis, you know, they now lost, you know, 13 soldiers yesterday. For them, the anger is, you know, ratcheted up as well. Do you see any script that gets us out of this?
Frankly, no. I think it's looking really quite bad. I mean, I have to say, this is a repeating pattern that we have these calls for truce and talks, which tend to have the effect of making the combatants think they've only got limited time to secure their objectives, which tends actually to ratchet up the pressure rather than cool it down. But we are clearly watching a humanitarian disaster. As you say, 500 Palestinians dead, I think 20 Israelis altogether, 100 Palestinians dead just yesterday. At least the Israelis can claim that they have knocked out some Palestinian tunnels. The Palestinians appear to have scored absolutely nothing.
Jeffrey, when you look at the situation, you know, 500 killed, scores of those are children, many others women. You know, certainly people had nothing to do with any of the attacks that have been taking place on Israel. But again, when you watch the news, when you see politicians speaking, and I understand this, you know, this is diplomacy and this is, you know, a time-worn thing, but it's almost no point of them going on TV because it's always exactly the same line. The line is, yes, of course, Israel has a right to defend itself. Both sides should stop. You need to have kind of, you know, some understanding of, you know, equal weight. And that's it. But nobody comes out to condemn Israel. Nobody has a way of contacting Hamas or, you know. So as John was saying, it's almost like nothing ever happens. It's like the same script again and again and again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was listening to Netanyahu yesterday, who I must say is very articulate at making his point. The problem is that you feel like you've heard it over and over, as you say. And his argument is, listen, you know, they are using, Hamas is using these people as shields. Their weapons are in their homes and around them. And they want us, you know, this is what he says. They want the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, to kill innocents so that they can up their propaganda game. That's his argument. The other argument is that they have found far more tunnels than they expected going into Israel from Gaza, and that they, until they get rid of those tunnels, they're not prepared to give up the ground game.
Yeah, but so far, you know, today they've hit a hospital. They hit, you know, four kids on a beach last week.
I don't think Israel wins here. I know. I mean, Israel may be temporarily securing its borders. The problem is, it's becoming harder and harder for all but the most hardline supporters of Israel to stand by and watch this happen.
Oddly, John, it has a kind of hideous echo of, you know, what we're seeing, you know, happening in Ukraine. You know, people take their sides and they'll believe what they believe, and you can't budge them with no matter what the evidence. You know, 500 people killed, you know, Israeli soldiers killed, you know. You can't change people's opinion in this situation. And each generation, it becomes more and more embedded.
Well, that's right. And I have this horrible sense that this is not the last tragedy of this kind we're going to see. I think, as I said before, I think it's a repeating pattern. Eventually, this assault will, one way or another, come to an end, but it'll start again at some point in the future.
Can they destroy Hamas while they're there?
I don't think so.
Oh, I think they've just recruited dozens and hundreds, if not thousands, of young men to join them. You know, I think that's the horrible reality of, you know, for a 16-year-old boy in Gaza to endure this, you know, if he was sitting on the fence before, this may well get him to sign up.
Well, let's finally jump to the last story for today, which is about China. There's been a huge crackdown on corruption in the country, with numerous officials being arrested of late and sent to trial. A turnaround for the country. John, you've watched China closely and for a long time. Do you think this is a sea change in how that country's being run?
I think there is a very serious attempt now to deal with corruption. I think there's a recognition that the Communist Party is rotten to the core with corruption. But I think the interesting new development is the regulation that came out in June. That party officials, in addition to not taking bribes, please, are not allowed to cheat on their wives. You're not allowed to commit adultery, and if you commit adultery, that's a breach of party regulations, which, of course, in the realities of China, can be used as part of the internal struggle. Beautifully, a senior party official, when asked what moral turpitude actually consists of, he said it's three mistresses or more. The first two don't really count.
Jeffrey, you know, when we look at China, you know, the situation seems to be slightly complicated. There's a whole generation now of people who've moved up through that country. You know, their kids are probably at school here in London, and they've made their money through that very corruption, through right. backhanders, through being given the rights to own companies, to have property, to develop land. It's a kind of unpickable, kind of, you know, corrupt whole network, isn't it?
I get the sense that I think the reality is that as much as some of this may be sincerely pointed, some of it's going to be used to weed out people that the leadership doesn't like. When you go for adultery, let's face it, in any country, you could pretty much clear out the cabinet rooms of any country. but you know, with China, when you have an absolute dictatorship like China, the notion of cleaning house and creating some unimpeachably honest bureaucratic mechanisms, it doesn't wash. It's hard enough in these democracies where we can actually turf people out and people can be fired and exposed in newspapers. But when it's the cronyism and when the state controls the media, when the state controls the internet, when the state controls the purse strings, I think, you know, you can make the effort, but I wouldn't expect great results.
And John, just finally, in a few seconds, do you think it's more aimed at kind of also bashing kind of Western companies who are doing rather well there rather than only its kind of homegrown people taking bribes?
I think that the Chinese authorities have taken into their hands a useful new weapon that can be used against all kinds of people, possibly including Western companies. Can I just sort of, to end, point out that the regulation appears to apply to men only? If you are a woman in China, you can cheat all you like. The party won't come after you.
Well, there you are. We've ended with some marriage advice as well about how to live in China and have your lovers as well. We're going to leave it there. That was Geoffrey Coffin, of course, and John Everard. Thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House. There's plenty still to come in the second half of Midori House, including a check-in with our Colombia correspondent.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, before we look at Brazilian soap operas and also what's happening to the Colombian metro, it's time now to get the world news headlines. Jonathan Wheatley.
Thank you very much. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has today questioned France's plan to sell Mistral helicopter carriers to Russia, saying fulfilling such an order would be unthinkable in Britain after the downing of the Malaysian Airlines plane in Ukraine. He spoke as fighting flared in the eastern city of Donetsk as investigators began to inspect the bodies of victims of that flight MH17, which crashed last week. 10 people have been killed, including a mother and 3 children, in a government airstrike on a militant-controlled town north of Baghdad on Monday, hospital sources and witnesses have said. An Israeli tank shell has hit the third floor of Al-Aqsa Hospital in central Gaza Strip on Monday, killing 4 people and wounding 16. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, 501 people have now died there during Israel's operation against Hamas militants. And the US President Barack Obama has signed an order on Monday protecting federally contracted workers from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. And that story ends this bulletin of Monocle 24 News.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. The time now is 21:31 in Moscow, and it's 18:31 here in London, and 14:31 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Earlier, I spoke to Anastasia Maloney in Bogota, who started by telling me about a meeting between the Colombian government and FARC rebel leaders taking place in Cuba.
At the moment, the two sides are in Havana discussing victims' rights. That's the third point of 5 talking points on a defined agenda, and it's to do with victims demanding that the FARC recognizes the suffering it's caused to hundreds and thousands of civilians, and victims are looking, in fact, to go to Havana and face and speak to the FARC commanders, and they want to find out where the mass graves are, where people are being buried, and they want really an apology and some sort of formal act of forgiveness on behalf of the FARC.
Now, as we've been covering this over the past few months, there's been an election, there's been some, you know, equivocation about whether actually this would carry through as a process, because some people are getting a little bit tired of all the discussion. They just want an end to this. What's your feeling? Do you think that it's, you know, it's just a very lengthy process and it may be, you know, another 9 months, a year before we get anywhere? Or do you think that people back in Colombia are beginning to get a little bit weary of these endless discussions?
The peace talks started in November 2012, and it's true that people have been very wary and quite sceptical about peace talks, but I think the momentum and the optimism about whether a peace deal can be reached is actually growing a bit, particularly since Santos, the president, was re-elected. In fact, many people say that he was re-elected precisely because people had faith in the peace process. That's not to say that people think there's going to be a peace deal quickly, but there seems to be a bit more optimism among Colombians if you ask them whether a peace process will get done this year. And Santos has reiterated many times that he says that there is a real possibility, a real chance that a peace deal will be signed by the end of this year.
And finally, just tell us, what are the remaining points then on that five-point agenda? Where else do we have to go before there is a proper peace deal?
So once the victims' rights have been discussed, which is happening now, there will be another point which is to do with who's going to verify that the FARC have actually laid down their arms. So that's the whole process of disarmament, and who's going to check that, and whether it's going to be continuous, or whether it's going to be done in phases, or whether it's just going to be done quickly. That is a major point to be discussed. And also a kind of a symbolic final signing saying that the conflict is over. That's another point, and how they're going to do that. And also, even if a peace deal does get signed, it's going to be put to a referendum for the Colombian people to decide whether or not they actually want the peace deal.
Now let's look at another topic, one that affects you probably on a day-to-day basis. This is the idea of Bogota getting a metro. Now, when you think back that Mexico City has had one for decades now, there's certainly a new one up and running in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro. Other Latin American cities are finally looking at building them too. Where are we at with Bogota getting a subway system?
I mean, this has been going on for decades, almost 70 years. Bogota has been talking about getting its first ever metro. And I think there is a real chance that it's actually going to get done soon. A study recently by Colombia's Institute of Urban Development said that there really will be a subway ready by 2020. Bogota's mayor has also said that the feasibility studies are in place, the budget is there. It's just a case now of starting the construction. And it's the first time that since I've been living in Bogota since 2002 that I really feel that this is going to get off the ground finally.
And tell me, actually, what's happening in many Latin American cities is there's this idea, that actually the bus is a cheaper and more effective solution for connecting poorer neighbourhoods to the city centre. You're certainly seeing that again in Brazilian cities where they've decided, actually, big subway systems too costly, let's go for the bus. Why have they decided now to push ahead with what is a very difficult and costly way of getting people around a city?
Well, actually, Bogota has a very good bus system. It's an electric bus that runs on dedicated lanes, and it's won awards and it's recognized for transporting people every day. However, there's just simply too much demand for transport, for public transport. And so Bogota's looked at what it has already, and it's not enough. So the idea is we've got to build a metro system because the demand is too great, the population's rising. This is a city of 8 million people. There's simply not enough alternatives and options for people to get around the city. The traffic is unbearable sometimes. So this is one way of alleviating the demand for public transport and trying to tackle the terrible traffic.
Now, let's look at an interesting brand story. Starbucks has announced it is going to open in Colombia. This is at a time when actually Starbucks has really suffered in many markets where it's seen that coffee is really taken more seriously. So, for example, in Australia, they've had a bit of a nightmare. And even here in central London, you're seeing many stores close as they kind of can't do battle with the independents. Why do they think they could make it in Colombia, the home of coffee?
That's right. I mean, it's people weren't quite sure why Starbucks decided to come into the Colombian market, because Colombia already has a very well-established and successful coffee brand itself, Juan Valdez. So Starbucks are saying that, look, there is a big growing middle class in Colombia. More people in Colombia are drinking good quality coffee, and that there is room for them in a highly competitive market. They're saying that they are going to support the local coffee grower. And what's special about the Starbucks in Colombia is that they will only use beans grown in Colombia, whereas in other Starbucks across the world, you'll get coffee from all over the world. So they're saying that that's one way they're going to support the Colombian coffee grower and hopefully get customers to buy coffee at their shop rather than the Juan Valdez coffee shop.
And just tell me, how successful are normally kind of US retail brands when they head south? Do you have the likes of a Gap on every corner? How well have those brands done when they've migrated?
In fact, the franchising of international brands like Gap has actually been quite a recent development. Gap came to Bogota only about a couple of years ago. Zara only and Mango as well, the Spanish brands, they also only came into the market, say, 5 years ago. So that's been something recent. But when they do come, there is a huge appetite for Colombians to buy foreign and U.S. brands. And as I said, this is part of a booming economy. People have more money to spend, and they want to see those brands in their high streets.
Well, that was Anastasia Maloney in Bogota. Up next, we'll ask whether Brazil's first on-screen gay kiss is getting anyone hot and bothered. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House, here on Monocle 24.
Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture on Monocle 24 is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you never knew you wanted to know about, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 culture shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Brazilians are no strangers to romantic TV drama, but their favourite soap operas have been given a shake-up. Earlier this year, a show featured the country's first ever gay kiss, which was the high point of the popular series Amor à Vida. On Friday, a lesbian couple on another show shared a loving embrace. The pair had been married in the previous episode, and today a new soap opera will take the trend even further. Imperio will have four gay characters in it. One of them will be played by the Brazilian macho TV star José Maia, whose character has an affair with a younger male model. Scenes that have already been shown to the press have got reviewers a little bit steamed up. But Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who is Brazilian and a big fan of these shows, told Tom Edwards that most people haven't really been that surprised.
Usually the soap operas, they show some advances in Brazilian society. I remember in the 70s, there was a big discussion about divorce. But I do have to say, they were a bit late on this gay issue. For example, we had the first gay kiss earlier this year in January in the soap opera Amor à Vida, which was historic. I mean, everybody loved it. And not many people were shocked, to be honest. And now, Globo, they just released a few statements saying that, I mean, they want gay kiss to become more normal. So they want to show, not just at the last episode, they don't want to create expectations from the public. They're just going to say it's just a normal couple as any other. And I think you can see the changes already.
So I wonder then, do you think that's a concerted effort then from the broadcasters to help viewers or maybe chivvy some viewers along to changing the way they look at gay relationships generally across all of society?
Absolutely. And I think Brazil, I mean, it's becoming quite a liberal country in terms of gay rights. We have gay weddings and gay adoption. But the problem is Brazil, we also have a lot of homophobic cases. It's a very dangerous country to be gay in a funny way. So we have, it's a country of contrasts. So I think Globo wants to kind of show this problem. And actually, one of their soap operas, they did show like a gang of attacking gay people in the streets, which is quite normal, I have to say, even though we have so many advanced rights in a way. So I think it's a good thing that Globo is doing that. A bit late, but you know.
Better late than never, they say.
Exactly,
they?
Exactly.
Let's talk about, I mentioned in the introduction a couple of these other soaps, En Familia, and the new one is Imperio. What are the characters then like? Are they going to be some sort of legendary characters who people will remember for years to come, do you think?
I think so. Before I talk about the new one, Imperio, let's talk about a little bit about En Familia, which just ended on Friday. First, I have to say it was a terrible soap opera. It was one of the lowest audiences ever. But this is just my opinion, I have to say that. But they did show a very interesting lesbian couple in the soap opera, Marina and Clara. And they got married in the end. They shared the loving kiss. But there was almost no controversy. People almost did not talk about that. But that became a story in itself. In a way. But now let's talk about Imperio, which starts today, and I hopefully it's going to be a better one than En Familia, but never mind. There'll be four gay characters in it, you know, and the most interesting, we're going to hear a clip, actually. Shall we hear now, and then I talk about
Let's play the clip. So this is from Imperio. Let's take a listen.
Até antes eu was... Pensei que você não vinha mais.
Desculpa se eu faltei ontem. Chega de ficar dando bandeira com a porta aberta. Alguém pode ver a gente aqui.
Calma.
Well, what's going on there, Fernando?
Very steamy. Basically, the character by the José Mayer is interpreting is called Claudio Bulgari. He's a ceremonialist married to a former Miss Brazil. She actually knows that he's gay, but just for society, he's still in the closet in a way. And he's got an affair with a younger male model in the soap opera. And basically, they're just talking and say, oh, just come to the bedroom. I miss you so much during the day. And I was very surprised because it's quite steamy, you know, in a way. I remember... The first gay kiss, you know, it was a very kind of cute gay couple in a way, you know, it was almost non-sexual in a way, but just in this first scene, scenes released to the press, you can see they're holding hands, they almost kissed, you know, and it's kind of dark, even the song.
They're setting their stall out a
bit. Exactly.
I just wonder, that's interesting that you've got this character, José Maya. I mean, is that in itself surprising that you've got this kind of macho guy, you know, very famous for playing these very tough roles?
Think Bruce Willis playing a gay character, you know, José Maya, he used to be like with a lot of women in the soap operas, used to play like farmers, quite rough, even a little bit rude man, but you know, women were in love, you know, he represents this Brazilian machismo in a way. But so I was very surprised, pleasantly surprised, that he's playing a gay character now. He's in the closet, but actually there'll be another gay character called Theo. He's going to be a gay blogger in the soap opera, and he's going to try to out him.
Ah, so it's a good narrative going on there.
Exactly.
Is it quite good business then, do you think, for a sort of a character actor, someone like Maya, to actually play a gay character? Do you think you're going to have actors sort of saying to their agents, hey, you know, I want to get a gay role. That's where the really interesting roles are. That's where the big money is now.
And what a change. I mean, that, for example, I remember in the 90s, you had an actor like André Gonçalves. He played a gay couple again with no kisses. But, you know, it was a gay couple. I think I was back in 95. He was actually somebody punched in the streets because he was playing a gay character. And I think this would be very unlikely today. I think actors probably, they would send scripts to the writers, oh, please write me a gay character. I think... It shows some respectability in a way, you know. So I think it's very good business to play.
And a very brief final thought, Fernando. Obviously, Brazil, you know, a huge Catholic country. Do you think that this is just a generally positive thing, both for at home and also for Brazil to sort of broadcast, as it were, to the whole world?
Exactly. I mean, so let's think about that. Soap operas is one of our main exports. So in a way, we even sell our soap operas to countries like Turkey, for example, countries that not even have gay rights in a way. So maybe they will see a Brazilian soap opera say, you know what, you know, let's improve our rights in a way.
Well, that was Fernando Augusto Pacheco talking to Tom Edwards there about gay soaps in Brazil. Well, they should listen to the Archers here in the UK, because they have a gay farmer. So poor José Maya, he was kind of like either a farmer or gay. Here in the UK, we've already combined both of them. Catch up, Brazil. Anyway, it's time now for a bit of music. We were talking a little bit earlier about journalists overstepping the mark, so I thought it only fitting to play a song that deals with just that subject. We couldn't get you the original, but here's Stephen Malkmus, his cover of the Bob Dylan classic, Ballad of the Thin Man. Listen to the lyrics and you'll understand. Well, that was Stephen Malkmus singing Bob Dylan's Ballad of a Thin Man. And apparently I lied to you earlier, and we could have got the Bob Dylan one. It's just our team prefer that. So there you go. Now, you're listening to Madrid House here on Monocle 24. And it's time now to review the best in the worlds of art.
and many other mediums too. But we're sticking with the art world today. And today in the studio, we have the art critic Fison Gunnar, editor of the website theartdesk.com, who's here to tell us about a few of the openings in London. We're going to start with Malevich at Tate Modern. Just to explain to us who Malevich was and why it's significant.
This is the exhibition of the summer, I would say. It's the big one. It's travelled from Amsterdam and a different version. We get a different version of Malevich. Now, Malevich, Kazimir Malevich, to use his full name, was a Russian artist. He was a Russian modernist artist. He was born in 1879 and he died in 1935. So he was born in Imperial Russia, born in Kiev, which was then a part of Imperial Russia, and then died under the Stalinist regime at the height of the Stalinist purges. And this exhibition, it basically follows the arc of his career. And it was, he was a prolific artist. We begin with his early figurative paintings, where he absorbs very quickly the French avant-garde movements, the isms of the time, cubism, futurism, Italian futurism, fauvism, and is quickly absorbing these. And then he does something so dramatic, so unprecedented. At the heart of this exhibition are his abstract paintings. And he painted in 1915 a painting called Black Square. And that really is, it's a big exhibition, but I would say that forms the heart of the exhibition because it's basically a simple black square on a white background. And the word iconic is so often used, it's overused to describe lots of minor radical artworks, but I think in this case it's warranted. It was absolutely revolutionary as an artwork. The only artwork of the 20th century to rival it is Marcel Duchamp's Urinal, otherwise known as Fountain. That he produced, he presented to the world in 1917.
Well, it's amazing that he was doing that in 1915. You think we're a full 100 years later and we're still getting kind of, all yes. upset about the unmade bed or something. You think here were the real radicals, yes. literally 100 years ago. Now, there's a big claim you made at the beginning that you said the exhibition of the summer here for London.
Yes.
What makes it such a great exhibition of his work?
Well, it's such an extensive and comprehensive overview of his full career. So we see him with his early figurative works, very radical, but then he pushes it further than any other artist of the 20th century. Painting can't go anywhere else after this point. When you think of the all-white or all-black paintings of American minimalism, 50-odd years later, the all-black paintings by an artist like Ad Reinhardt or the all-white paintings of an artist like Robert Ryman, this is in the 50s and 60s. Well, we're actually, if you think that these were painted, his white-on-white paintings, he also produced white paintings. When you think of what he was doing in 1915 and 19, well, he produced his white paintings in 1918, then the radicalism that you see 50 years after doesn't seem so radical. He was there generations earlier, and he really was. If Duchamp is the father of conceptualism, then Malevich is the father of conceptualism and minimalism. He really spawned a great many movements. It was very difficult to know where to go with painting after Malevich.
Okay, well that's on in London now, all the way through to 26th of October. Another show, which is on at the National Portrait Gallery, looks at the life of Virginia Woolf, obviously the key member of the Bloomsbury Review. What did you make of this?
I thought it was a tremendous exhibition. How do you stage an exhibition, a successful exhibition of a writer? Where do you go? How do you kind of explore her genius, her impact on She's another modernist artist, but in the field of writing. So it's a bit more tricky to stage an exhibition to explore her work. Well, as you say, she was at the heart of the Bloomsburys. So the way you do it is through paintings, portraits, photographs, because, you know, her sister, Vanessa Bell, was a leading painter. Her brother-in-law, Duncan Grant, was another leading modernist painter. So she was at the heart of a modernist visual culture in this country. But all that is kind of interesting. But the heart of this exhibition, actually, and where it really takes off, and what makes this exhibition come alive, is the personal effects, the letters, the personal items. I mean, the letters that Virginia Woolf wrote to her sister and her husband, Leonard, talking of her despair. I mean, listeners will know that she suffered throughout her life with depression, with a mental illness, and she committed suicide finally in 1941. And it's the personal effects that bring this exhibition alive. But it's teeming with objects and things and paintings and photographs. I mean, it's as close as we can get to Virginia Woolf without actually reading her novels. But, you know, you leave the exhibition wanting to read her.
Well, so it made me want to go. It sounds amazing. Now, obviously, at the moment, there's lots of discussion about the anniversary for the First World War, the outbreak of the First World War. And the galleries at the Imperial War Museum have been done up a little bit. £40 million spent on a new gallery there.
Yeah.
And you've been to see that.
Yeah, it's quite a transformation. It's quite an understated transformation. They've added a new stairwell. Everything's painted in kind of grey. It's quite understated, but they've introduced a new permanent exhibition, a series of galleries basically devoted to the First World War. And it's there've been bits and pieces around in London. The National Portrait Gallery put a recent exhibition exploring the portraits of the First World War, but this is much more extensive, and it's not just about the war itself and how it was fought in the trenches. I mean, all that is well documented and many listeners are familiar with that. But it really homes in on the impact on the home front and how civilian life was affected, how the everyday, civilian population was affected by the war. And it does that, you know, through letters, through artifacts, through photographs. Again, it's not at all dry. It's incredibly moving. It's just one of the most moving exhibitions I've seen, actually.
Well, Fison, thank you very much for coming in. That's three great shows to see if you're in London. And thank you very much to Fison Gunnar for being our guide today. Well, that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guest, Jeffrey Kaufman, and to John Everard. Today's show was produced by Marika Peters. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.